Welcome back to Driving Progress with Audi and me, Sonia Lennon. Join me throughout the series as I speak to a number of Audi brand ambassadors and special guests about living their passions, personal beliefs, the importance of progress, and their attitudes towards the future. We welcome you to experience progress with Audi. First up is Audi Ireland brand ambassador Rob Kearney, one of Ireland's most well-known and successful rugby players. Throughout a very storied career, Rob played with Leinster and Ireland for over a decade at the highest level and also travelled on two British and Irish Lions tours, culminating in a stint playing in Australia. In terms of achievements, well, I could go on and on. Let's just say it's all very impressive. Welcome to the podcast, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think I joined you as Audi ambassador coming up on 5 years ago. How long have you been working with Audi?
I think I'm a little bit over 10.
Wow.
So I'm bringing the grey hair to the group, well, unfortunately.
I'll say nothing in answer to that. It's great to have you here again, and I've had the honour of being in your company over those 5 years that I've been with Audi. And looking at your evolution over, say, that decade, is it safe to say you're a very different person now than you were then?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I'm sure if we all delve deep into our own progression over the course of any 10-year period, we've all changed a huge amount. But I think particularly, you know, I'm 36 now. If I look back to the type of person I was when I was 26, they're big years in terms of your development as a person. So I would say, yes, I'm very different, and I would hope different for the better.
What have you learned then in that 10 years?
You know, how long is a piece of string? You know, I think the older you get, you know, your outlook on life is very different. I think you get better at identifying things, areas, people that are more important to you. You know, your ability to deal with setbacks is obviously improved an awful lot more.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it's almost like a sort of a distillation. Things slough away, they fall off, they cease to be important. As we get that little bit older, it is that kind of a sort of a much more clarified prioritization in the way we live our lives.
Yeah, it is. But we get busier too. The older you get, generally the busier you get. That idea of prioritizing the more important things in your life becomes a priority. Now, I will often say that, you know, as time goes by, there's lots of things that you probably look back and you wish that you prioritize more. You look at some of the friendships that maybe have dwindled over the years and you look back and say, I wish I'd worked a little bit harder on keeping those. But then you could argue the other side of that, that things that are truly important to you are the things that you spend more time nurturing.
Do you feel busier now than you did at the height of a grueling training regime?
Yeah, I do. I feel an awful lot busier. When I was playing, there was only one thing in life that was important to me, and that was rugby, that was playing for Leinster, playing for Ireland, and nothing ever came in the way of that. You know, everything that you would do from the first thing on Monday morning to Friday evening was to prepare you as best as you can for an 80-minute period the following day. You know, I've retired now. It's coming up 16 months. And it's challenging. You're trying to find your new way in life. You've got a new identity. I think the thing that I've probably found most challenging was trying to find that purpose again. You know, like I mentioned, you get out of bed since the day I was 5 or 6, and the only thing I wanted to do was play rugby. So that was my pure passion. That was my purpose. It was the only thing that I identified with. And then you wake up one day and you're told, that's it, you can't do that anymore. You have to go and find a new skill set. And I think it's a very difficult thing. It's not something that many people have to compete with. You know, without being too morbid about it, they say sports people die twice in their lifetime, the day they retire from the sport and the day they finally kick the bucket, whenever that is. But I can very much relate to that.
And so what I suppose, with your strategic brain and all the smarts that you bring to that, were you able to kind of work backwards and sort of think about what that might look like in advance of it actually happening?
Yeah, you try to prepare yourself for it. You try to put loads of parameters in place to try and make the transition a little bit easier. But then there's some things that don't prepare you for it too. You know, I did an awful lot of studying when I was playing because I thought it would help me transition a little bit easier. You know, I got involved in lots of different businesses, more to have an outlet away from sport at the time, but also with one eye in the future to ensure that I was actively involved in something.
Because you spent a recovery period doing an MBA, am I right?
Yeah, I was out injured for a year in 2013, and I knew I wasn't going to be playing for a season, so I needed to do something else that at the end of the year that I had something to show for it. And my mum was always a huge driver in the family for ensuring that we upskilled ourselves. And that was bred into us from a very young age. You know, my dad was the sporty father, and they sort of played good cop, bad cop when it came to sport versus the academics.
Which is great to have that balance, you know, and her influence obviously helped you to make those preparations. But it feels like that business interest has sort of always been there.
Yeah, it has. I was 24 when I did the MBA, and I'd already done a primary degree. So I was 25 when that was finished. So it felt like the next natural progression for me was to try and put all of these learnings into place in real life practice. And, you know, some of the business ventures came around out of the blue. Others I went looking for. Some of them were supporting really close friends in their ambition to building and driving a company forward. So they're all very different how they came around. But I think at the time it just seemed like the next step in my progression off the field.
And in terms of your development then, as a business person, as an investor, as somebody who's driving products and brands, do you see yourself very different now in terms of your approach to it?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely an awful lot smarter in terms of the ventures that I get behind, the people that I get behind. My business acumen will have improved a little bit. But I certainly am not the type of individual who's going to be a founder of a startup and drive it forward. That's not in my nature. I need to be around people. I need to be working in a team. And that's why I have so much respect for not just individual people in business, but in sport as well. When they work on their own, they don't have that support system of teammates around them. If they have a bad day, it's just them and themselves. Whereas, you know, if we as a team ever had a bad day, there was a squad of 40 players and 15 coaches. So it's much easier to rally together and get over it.
It's really interesting, you know, because I was having this conversation the other day about this concept of adopted pace and adopted culture that, you know, we spend so much time in the workplace, whatever that workplace might be. We have options then to keep that adopted pace and culture in the rest of our lives or to rally against it, you know? So do you think that there are parts of the culture and pace of your playing days that have come with you?
Yeah, I think I've been altered enormously by that. Now, sport is very different because I don't think there's many workplaces out there with the same deep-rooted culture and the same pace to succeed as within a sports team. And I'm sure there's lots of business leaders who'll be thinking now, well, you know, how can you comment on that? My only point is that back to my very first thing that I said on this, that I would do anything during the week to make sure I got picked on the team at the weekend, and nothing was going to come between that. I'm not sure everyone in a workplace has that same mindset. Okay, the CEO, the people at the very top of the organization might, but I don't think it transcends right through the culture to every employee on the ground, whereas in a sports team it did.
And I suppose that sports team is a department in itself that is singular and has one purpose, to win, to play, to win.
Yeah, and I love that idea, that notion of one purpose. There is a relentless connotation to it that nothing else gets in the way of achieving that purpose, of achieving that growth, that desire to always wanting to be better. And, you know, for me, that's exactly what progress is.
So where is that feeling? Where are you getting that feeling now in your world?
It's difficult. I don't get it to the same extent that I used to. I've had lots of conversations with myself. Am I ever going to be able to replicate that? Does it come to a point where you just say to yourself that, you know, those amazing highs that I experienced, that relentless drive to be better, chasing one singular dream, am I ever going to reach those heights again? I don't know.
And is there a bit of you that is still kind of chasing that, or do you feel like you don't need it anymore?
No, I'm not chasing it at the moment. I'd like to be able to say someday over the course of the next 35 years of my life that something has come close to it. But I was very adamant when I retired that I needed to be super patient with myself, that I wasn't going to find something immediately that was going to replicate all of those things.
Like the breakup date. No, you're right. And I think it is dangerous to be reactionary to that sort of seismic shift and that idea that it is about kind of redefining your own identity. These are milestone moments, I suppose. And it was very brave not to jump into something in a way.
Because it's a very easy trap to fall into. And I'm not saying that, you know, professional sports people are wired differently. But you have that insane ambition. And through the course of your life, it's always been about achieving, getting to the top of whatever field you're in. And a lot of people who have gone on to be professional sports people will have an element of that in their personality. So it would be a very easy trap to fall into coming out of sport and trying to take that exact same mindset into a new life that you've no skill set in, that you haven't spent a huge amount of time developing yourself in. And I think that's an easy trap to fall into.
So what do you think your, you know, key skills are now from this position? What are you adding to the companies that you're involved with? And where are you shining?
I think sports people can undersell themselves an awful lot. Okay, you know, a lot of sports people might go into an element of business when they finish up. And most sports people won't know how to use the inner dealings of a computer. So straight away, they'll put themselves on the back foot and say, well, I don't understand how business works. P&L spreadsheet, have no idea what that is. Excel, all of those things. But we have developed and nurtured so many amazing skills along the way that are actually unbelievably valuable.
And transferable.
To companies.
Oh, my goodness.
And transferable. And I think we take them as sports people very much for granted because we did them every day. The people in our environment did them every day. And it's only when you step out of that setting, that sporting environment, and you go into the real world, the business world, that it dawns on you that maybe not everyone commits to them as much as you thought.
It's so interesting. You know, I wrote about this recently, this concept that the things that come easy to us, we assume that they come easy to everybody, you know, and that is why we undervalue them because they're easy. So what are the transferable skills? I mean, I probably think I know what they are, but what does that sort of elite level give you that can be applied anywhere?
Yeah, we're talking very basic, but again, they might just be very basic to me, but timekeeping is something that would have been so important to us. Every meeting would start 5 minutes early. And if you weren't 5 minutes early, you were late. Communication, something so important to us. We used to do it in non-stressful times of the day, but also with 5 minutes to go in a World Cup game, the whole world is watching and you have to communicate with the people around you. You have to make decisions under pressure. You've got to be adaptable to what you're seeing in front of you. You know, go through a list of injuries that we've all had to deal with, you know, gives you a huge amount of resilience, dealing with setbacks, you know, being able to work in a team with lots of different personalities, all of these things that just became so natural to us. And they are the things that make organizations tick. They are the things that are really important to a culture of a team or an organization.
It's interesting that you mention timekeeping. I was really taken, actually, with the commentary around Man United's recent win. One of the commentators was citing the punishment of Marcus Rashford in his timekeeping as being part of an evolution of the culture. And this idea that a leader sets cultural expectations. And a lot of what you're talking about is pure leadership from a behavioral point of view. And I think people tend to think about leadership as being positional. You know, she's in charge, he's in charge. Leadership is required at every level of team sports, I think.
Yeah, it's so important. And leadership starts with yourself, first and foremost. You've got to be able to lead yourself and live your own values and fit into a team. If you can't fit into a team, you're not going to survive in that team, but you're not going to be able to fulfill your potential in that team. Leaders drive culture, but there's so many different types of leaders too. And I've been lucky enough to play with so many captains, so many great coaches. Some of them would be very vocal with their messages. Others wouldn't be vocal at all. They'll just lead by their actions. But the traits in leaders are all the same. You know, they're very authentic. You build a huge level of trust with them. You know that they care the same, if not more, than you about the outcome. You know, I've mentioned the trustworthy piece. It's very important. If they say they're going to do something, they do it. You know, if a leader breaks your trust once, it's gone. They create the culture, but I'm a big believer that everyone in a group is responsible for driving the culture forward. And you go into a lot of teams, a lot of companies, and they might have their values up on the wall and it's come from the CEO top down and they say, this is how I want you to act, this is how I want you to behave. And it's very difficult for employees to take on someone else's values. I'm a big believer that you include everyone in the process of it, that, you know, if you're the CEO, they're not just your values, that it's been a discussion amongst everyone and there are values. Because what happens then is I feel a little bit of ownership towards them, but also there's pressure on me to deliver them because I've contributed to them. And I need to take a little bit of ownership into driving it forward.
There's
too.
There's a sense of endowment there that you're part of it. And actually, I know for myself, it's one of my failings, is that I tend to move quite fast in business. And I sometimes forget to bring people with me. I know that now, you know. So I'm constantly in a state of trying to, you know, address that and mitigate it and make sure that I'm bringing people with me. And I think that's, it's probably part of being an entrepreneur that there is that kind of constant agility and pace in what we do. So, yeah, I absolutely hear you with that.
The relentless nature of the next thing, the next thing. And it's easy sometimes not to just stand still for a minute and actually look back. I think sometimes we can always be so obsessed with looking forward and the next thing that we never stop and take stock of the things that we've achieved, but also looking back at the things that we haven't done particularly well too, because the best learnings are in the past.
We had an experience where a business myself and Brendan had failed. I just remember there being so much emotion wrapped around that failure. We didn't know what to do, and we made a decision to do nothing, which is rarely the right thing to do. Do you know what I mean? It's particularly in business, it's rarely the right thing to do. And I remember talking to Brendan and saying, let's just go and enjoy the summer, reconvene in September, and then see how we feel. And when we got back in September, I suppose we realized that nobody cared. Businesses fail all the time. And the emotion of that pain had diffused to the point where we could see the reality of our situation clearly. I think how we respond to things, and you spoke about communicating at the right time. You're communicating when emotions are not running high. And that takes a bit of emotional intelligence to understand that as well, I think.
Yeah, I think any successful people, and you've gone on to build some great businesses after that, you look back on those failures as really important times, provided you're prepared to try and learn from it and do a full diagnostic on what worked, what didn't work. You know, I'm a huge believer that there's a big difference between mistakes and failures. If you genuinely prepare to the best of your ability, if you do everything that you think was right at that moment in time and you make a mistake, that's okay. If you continue to make that same mistake time and time again, that's not good. I think the failures only come about if we haven't prepared to the best of our ability. And that's why that preparation piece is very important. And it was instilled in all of our sports teams.
So what of the businesses that you're involved in now, where are you getting energy?
Yeah, so like I said, I've probably gotten a little bit busier since I've stopped. Venture capital was always something that I was interested in. I liked helping new companies find their way, getting involved in startups. So I do 3 days a week now in a company called Elkstone Private. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and learning loads there. They've got lots of different arms to their business. And it's very enjoyable because I'm learning lots and I'm just taking it all in. The 3 days a week was a very conscious decision because I sort of need 2 days for all of my own other bits and pieces going on, which might be, you know, some of the businesses that I'm involved in, do some corporate stuff. And then TV on the weekend. So some weeks can be very busy, but because there's lots of different things going on, that can be quite energetic too.
There's another small time suck that's about to present itself. You're going to need another day in the week or two, Rob.
I think you're right. August time, myself, my wife expecting our first child, which is very exciting. I certainly feel that the time is right. From my end, anyway, at 36 years of age, you have to grow up eventually.
Eventually, I suppose.
But yeah, that's going to bring about a very different outlook on life, I'm sure. And just, yeah, very excited.
What sort of father do you want to be?
I suppose, you know, I look back at my own father, very happy memories of my upbringing. I was hugely supportive. He was to me, to my sporting ambitions, was never overly pushy in any way. But after a game, he'd always be the first person I'd speak to because I know he would give me a very honest account of how I was. Of course, I'm sure there was an element of bias there along the way, but you know, you haven't even had the child yet and we're talking about this, but I would imagine as a parent, your first and most important remit is that you just want your kids to be happy. You want to instill really good values into them. And I think if you've achieved that, you've done a pretty good job.
Yeah. So values, what are the ones that you live and die by?
I think hard work is important. You have to be someone who's prepared to graft, be committed to something. I find it very difficult to watch people with a huge amount of ability, but they don't necessarily fulfill it all. I think kindness, loyalty, very important for your friends. I think it's very important for people to have a strong friendship circle of friends around them. And if you have those traits, the chances are that you'll have lots of really good close friends.
And do you think the concept of, you know, having to put in that hard work is slightly subsumed in our conversation today? I suppose it's not a very sexy concept, the fact that you have to work hard to get what you want. And I don't think there's an awful lot of conversation around it. And I agree with you. I think it's key.
Yeah, now I will caveat that by saying I genuinely feel myself very lucky to, from such a young age, having a very clear roadmap of what I wanted to do. And that instilled all the hard work into me. Now, I'm sure there might be lots of people out there, you know, without, take a banker, for example. I'm not sure there's too many 4, 5, 6-year-olds out there now who dream of being bankers. Okay, they might.
Answers on a postcard, please.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be one or two. But you get my point of, yeah, being very young and having a single goal. So it made it very easy for me just to be relentlessly driven towards that.
Yeah, you're right. And it tends to be the very alluring goals that instill themselves very early. You know, it's either, you know, fame or prowess or elite in some area that is very attractive, you know. So I think if you look at, say, fashion or music, sport, politics, I'm not so sure, but you know, it's those big ticket items that's the stuff I think that gets instilled pretty early. I would love to ask you, is there, because, you know, there's a lot going on there with Elkstone and your own businesses, is there a sort of an idea of what the ideal scenario is sort of 5 years from now? You've got your 5-year-old progeny in your arms. You're excelling as a father.
No, there's not. When I was playing, I would always have had goals in the short term, the medium term, the long term. I don't have those now. And I think that's part of the patience component to all of this. You know, I have no idea what line of work I'll be in 5 years' time. I might be full-time on TV or not on TV at all. I might actually have tried to start my own business. I suppose the nature of the last year and subsequent years coming after this is very much about experiencing lots of different things out there to try and find and replicate that purpose and passion as close as I can.
Takes great patience and self-belief to be able to take that time and to not feel rushed by other people's expectations.
Yeah, I was never one for concerning with other people's expectations. Certainly I don't know what other people's expectations are of me. I'm not sure if they have any, but I was always I was probably my own biggest critic, without a doubt, throughout my career. You know, I'd like to think that I've got pretty good self-awareness. And if you're comfortable in your own skin, if you're comfortable with your own awareness, well, then really your own expectations of the future should all be that matters.
Rob Carney, thank you so much for your time and for being a part of Driving Progress with Audi.
Thank you for having me.